No. Let's just try it, huh? He hit the little red button. A hemi-disc of blue light shot out over their heads from the cylindrical section of the machine and sliced through the containers he had stacked against the door. Fluids spurted out of them. The shelves to one side collapsed, supports severed by the humming blue disc. He grinned at the wreckage. If he'd still been standing, the blue field would have cut him in half. Nice try, Doc, he said. The little doctor slumped to the floor like a pile of wet sand as the stun pistol hummed. Snack packets and drink cartons showered onto the floor from the demolished shelves. The wands falling through the blue beam hit the floor shredded. Drink poured from the punctured containers in front of the door. There was a thumping noise coming from behind the containers. He rather appreciated the heady smell of alcohol filling the storeroom, but hoped there wasn't enough spirits involved to cause a fire. He spun the machine around, splashing through the drink gradually collecting on the floor of the small storeroom. The flickering blue half-disc cut through more shelves before sinking into the bulkhead opposite the door. The machine shook, the air filled with a teeth-cracking whine, and black smoke spun round against the wrecked shelves as though propelled by the cutting blue light, and then fell quickly to the surface of the sloshing drink filling the bottom decimeter of the storeroom, where it collected like a tiny dark fog bank. He started manipulating the controls on the machine. A little hollow screen showed the shape of the field. He found a couple of tiny joysticks that altered it, producing an elliptical field. The machine thumped harder. The noise rose in pitch and black smoke poured out around him. The thumping from behind the door got louder. The black smoke was rising in the room and already he felt lightheaded. He pushed hard against the machine with his shoulder. It trundled forward, howling. Something gave. He put his back against the machine and pushed with his feet. There was a bang from in front of the machine and it started to roll away from him. He turned, pushed with his shoulder again, staggering past smoking shelves through a glowing hole into a wrecked room full of tall metal cabinets. Drink spluttered through the gap. He held the machine steady for a moment. He opened one of the cabinets to find a glittering mass of hair-fine filaments wrapped round cables and rods. Lights winked on a long, thin control board like some linear city seen at night. He pursed his lips and made a kissing sound at the fibres. Congratulations, he said to himself. You have won a major prize. He hunkered down at the humming machine, adjusted the controls to something like the way Stapp had had them, but producing a circular field, then switched it to full power. The blue disc slammed into the grey cabinets in a blinding maelstrom of sparks. The noise was numbing. He left the machine where it was and waddled away under the blue disc, splashing back into the control room. He eased himself over the still unconscious doctor, kicked the containers away from the door and removed the metal tool from the door. The blue beam wasn't extending far through the gap from the control room, so he stood up, shoved the door open with his shoulder and fell out into the arms of a startled ship's officer, just as the field machine blew up and blasted both of them across the bar and into the lounge. All the lights in the lounge went out. Numeral 3. The hospital ceiling was white, like the walls and the sheets. Outside, on the surface of the berg, all was white as well. Today was a whiteout. A bright scour of dry crystals wheeling past the hospital windows. The last 4 days had been the same while the storm wind blew, and the weather people said they expected no break for another 2 or 3 days. He thought of the troops hunkered down in trenches and ice caves, afraid to curse the howling storm because it meant there would probably be no fighting. The pilots would be glad too, but pretend they were not, and would loudly curse the storm that prevented them from flying. Having looked at the forecast, most would now be getting profoundly drunk. He watched the white windows. Seeing the blue sky was supposed to be good for you. That was why they built hospitals on the surface. Everything else was under the surface of the ice. The outer walls of the hospital were painted bright red, so that they would not be attacked by enemy aircraft. He had seen enemy hospitals from the air strung out across the white glare of the berg's snow hills, like bright drops of blood fallen frozen from some wounded soldier. A whirl of whiteness appeared briefly at one window as the snow flurry circled on some vortex in the gale, then disappeared. He stared at the falling chaos beyond the layers of glass, eyes narrowing, as though by sheer concentration he might find some pattern in the inchoate blizzard. He put one hand up, touching the white bandage which circled his head. His eyes closed as he tried, again, to remember. His hand fell to the sheets over his chest.
"How are we today?" said the young nurse.
She appeared at the bedside, holding a small chair. She placed the chair between his bed and the empty one to his right. All the other beds were empty. He was the only person in the ward. There hadn't been a big attack for a month or so. She sat down. He smiled, glad to see her, and glad that she had the time to stop and talk.
"Okay," he nodded, still trying to remember what happened.
She smoothed her white uniform over her lap.
"How are your fingers today?"
He held up both hands, waggled the fingers on his right hand, then looked at his left. The fingers moved a little. He frowned.
"About the same," he said, as though apologizing.
"You're seeing the doc this afternoon. He'll probably get the physios to take a look at you."
"What I need is a physio for my memory," he said, closing his eyes briefly.
"I know there was something important I had to remember." His voice trailed off. He realized he'd forgotten the nurse's name.
"I don't think we have such things," she smiled.
"Did they have them where you came from?"
This had happened before. Yesterday, hadn't it? Hadn't he forgotten her name yesterday, too?
He smiled.
"I ought to say I don't remember," he said, grinning. "But no, I don't think they did."
He'd forgotten her name yesterday and the day before, but he'd come up with a plan. He'd done something about it. Perhaps they didn't need them there, with that thick skull of yours. She was still smiling. He laughed, trying to remember what the plan was he'd come up with. Something to do with blowing, with breath and paper.
"Perhaps not," he agreed. "His thick skull. That was why he was here. A thick skull. A skull thicker, or at least more hardy, than they were used to. A thick skull that had not quite shattered when somebody had shot him in the head. But why, when he had not been fighting at the time, when he'd been amongst his own side, his fellow pilots? Fractured instead. Fractured, broken, but not smashed irretrievably. He looked to one side, where there was a little cabinet. A fold of paper lay on its surface.
"Don't tire yourself out trying to remember things," the nurse said. "Maybe you won't remember things. It doesn't matter very much. Your mind has to heal too, you know."
He heard her talk, took in what she was saying, but he was trying to remember what it was he'd told himself the day before. That little slip of paper. He had to do something to it.
He blew at it. The top of the folded paper slip hinged up, so that he could see what was written underneath. "Talib." The paper sank back again. He'd angled it, he remembered now, so that she couldn't see. Her name was Talib.
Of course, it sounded familiar.
"I am healing," he said. "But there was something I had to remember, Talib. It was important, I know it was." She stood up, patted him on one shoulder.
"Forget it. You mustn't worry yourself. Why not take a nap? Shall I draw the curtains?"
"No," he said.
"Can't you stay longer, Talib?"
"You need your rest, Sharadanin," she said, putting one hand to his brow.
"I'll be back soon to take your temperature and change your dressings. Ring the bell if you need anything else."
She patted his hand and went away, taking the small white chair with her. She stopped at the doors, looked back.
"Oh, yes. Did I leave a pair of scissors here last time I changed your dressing?"
He looked around him and shook his head.
"Don't think so."
Talib shrugged.
"Oh, well."
She went out of the ward. He heard her put the chair down on the corridor floor as the doors swung closed. He looked at the window again. Talib took the chair away each time because he'd gone crazy when he'd first seen it, when he woke up for the first time. Even after that, when his mental state seemed more stable, he would shiver, wide-eyed with fear when he woke each morning, just because the white chair was sitting there at the side of his bed. So they had stacked the ward's few chairs out of his sight in one corner, and Talib, or the doctors, brought the chair in from the corridor with them when they came to see him. He wished he could forget that. Forget about the chair,
and the chair maker. Forget about the stubberind. Why did that stay sharp and fresh after so many years and so long a journey? And yet, whatever had happened just a few days ago, when somebody had shot him, left him for dead in the hangar, that was dim and vague as something seen through the storm of snow. He stared at the frozen clouds beyond the window, the amorphous frenzy of the snow. Its meaninglessness mocked him. He slumped down in the bed, letting the piled bedclothes submerge him like some drift, and slept. His right hand under the pillow curled round one leg of the scissors he'd taken from Taliba's tray the day before.
"How's the head, old buddy pal?"
Sayaz Insail tossed him a fruit which he failed to catch. He picked it up off his lap, where it had landed after hitting his chest.
"Getting better," he told the other man.
Insail sat on the nearest bed, threw his cap on the pillow, unfastened the top button of his uniform. His short, spiky black hair made his pale face look white as the blankness still filling the world beyond the ward windows.
"How are they treating you?"
"Fine."
"Damn good-looking nurse you've got out there."
"Taliba," he smiled. "Yes, she's okay." Insail laughed and sat back on the bed, supporting himself with his arms splayed out behind.
"Only okay? Zakalwe, she's gorgeous. You get bed baths?"
"No, I'm able to walk to the bathroom.
Want me to break your legs?"
"Perhaps later," he laughed. Insail laughed a little too, then looked at the storm beyond the windows. "How about your memory? Getting any better?" He picked at the doubled-over white sheet near where his cap lay. "No," he said. In fact, he thought it might be. But somehow, he didn't want to tell people. Maybe he thought it would be bad luck. "I remember being in the mess and that card game. Then he remembered seeing the white chair at his bedside and filling his lungs with all the air in the world and screaming like a hurricane until the end of time, or at least until Taliba came and calmed him.
"Livueta," he whispered. "Dark Livueta?"
He shrugged. "Then I was here." "Well," Sayaz said, straightening the crease on his uniform trousers, "the good news is we managed to get the blood off the hangar floor. I expect it to be returned."
"Deal, but we're not cleaning it."
"How are the others?" Sayaz sighed, shook his head, smoothed the hair at the back of his neck.
"Oh, just the same dear, lovable, fine bunch of lads they ever were."
He shrugged. "The rest of the squadron said to send their best wishes for a rapid recovery, but you pissed them off that night." He looked sadly at the man in the bed. "Sherry, old pal, nobody likes the war, but there are ways of saying so. You just did it wrong. I mean, we all appreciate what you've done. We know this isn't really your battle, but I think some of the guys even feel bad about that. I hear them sometimes. You must have, at night, having nightmares. You can see that look in their eyes sometimes, like they know how bad the odds are, and they just aren't going to come through all this. They're scared. They might try to put a bullet through my head if I said so to their face. But scared is what they are. They'd love a way out of this war. They're brave men, and they want to fight for their country, but they want out. And nobody who knew the odds would blame them. Any honourable excuse. They wouldn't shoot themselves in the foot, and nowadays they won't go for a walk outside in ordinary shoes and come back with frostbite because too many did that early on. But they'd love a way out of this. You don't have to be here, but you are. You choose to fight. And a lot of them resent you for it. It makes them feel like cowards because they know that if they were in your boots, they'd be on land telling the girls what a brave pilot they have the chance to dance with. I'm sorry I upset them." He touched the bandages on his head. "I'd no idea they felt this strongly, though."
"They don't."
Insail frowned. "That's what's weird." He got up and walked over to the nearest window, looking out at the blizzard.
"Shit, Sherry. Half those guys would have gladly invited you into the hangar and done their best to lose you a couple of teeth, but a gun."
He shook his head. "There's not one of those guys I'd trust behind me with a bread roll or a handful of ice cubes. But if it was a gun..." He shook his head again. "I wouldn't think twice. They just aren't like that."
"Maybe I imagined it all, Sayaz," he said.
Sayaz looked round, a worried expression on his face. It melted a little when he saw his friend was smiling.
Sherry, I admit I don't want to imagine I'm wrong about one of them. But the alternative is just somebody else. I don't know who. The military police don't know either.
I don't think I was much help to them, he confessed.
Sayers came back, sat down on the other bed again.
You really have no idea who you talked to afterwards.
Where you went?
None.
You told me you were going to the briefing room to check out the latest targets.
Yes, so I've heard.
But when Jine went there to invite you to step into the hangar for saying such terrible things about our high command and our lower tactics, you weren't there.
I don't know what happened, Sayers. I'm sorry, but I just...
He felt tears prick behind his eyes. The suddenness surprised him. He put the fruit back down in his lap. He made a very large sniffing noise, rubbed his nose and coughed, patted his chest.
I'm sorry, he repeated.
Insile watched the other man for a moment as he reached for a handkerchief from the bedside table. Sayers shrugged, grinned broadly.
Hey, never mind. It'll come back to you.
Maybe it was just some loony ground crewman pissed off because you'd stepped on his fingers once too often.
If you want to remember, don't try too hard.
Yeah. Get some rest? I've heard that before, Sayers. He picked the fruit from his lap, placed it on the bedside cabinet.
Can I get you anything for next time?
Insile asked. Apart from Taliba, on whom I may have designs myself if you refuse to rise to the occasion.
No thanks. Booze?
No, I'm saving myself for the messroom bar.
Books?
Really, Sayers, nothing.
Zakalwe?
Sayers laughed. There isn't even anybody else here for you to talk to. What do you do all day? He looked at the window, then back at Sayers.
I think quite a lot, he said.
I try to remember. Sayers came over to the bed. He looked very young. He hesitated, then punched him gently in the chest. He glanced at the bandages.
Don't get lost in there, old buddy pal.
He was expressionless for a moment.
Yeah, don't worry. But anyway, I'm a good navigator.
There was something he'd meant to tell Sayers Insile, but he couldn't remember what that was either. Something that would warn him, because there was something that he knew about that he hadn't known about before, and something that required warning. The frustration of it made him want to scream sometimes, to tear the white plump pillows in half and pick up the white chair and smash it through the windows to let the mad white fury out there inside. He wondered how quickly he'd freeze if the windows were open.
Well, at least it would be appropriate.
He'd arrived here frozen, so why not leave the same way? He entertained the thought that some cell memory, some bone-remembered affinity had drawn him here, of all places, where the great battles were fought on the titanic, crashing tabular bergs, carved from their vast glaciers and swirling like ice cubes in some planet-sized cocktail glass, a scatter of ever-shifting frozen islands, some of them hundreds of kilometres long, circling the world between pole and tropic, their broad backs a white wasteland spattered with blood and bodies and the wrecks of tanks and planes. To fight for what would inevitably melt and could never provide food or minerals or a permanent place to live seemed an almost deliberate caricature of the conventional folly of war. He enjoyed the fight, but even the way the war was fought disturbed him, and he had made enemies amongst the other pilots and his superiors by speaking his mind. But somehow he knew that Sayers was right. It had not been what he'd said in the mess that had led to somebody trying to kill him. At least, said something in him, not directly. Thone, the squadron's CO, came to see him. No flunkies for a change.
Thank you, Nas,
he said at the door, then closed it, smiled, and came over to the bed. He had the white chair. He sat in it and drew himself up so that his girth was made to look less.
Well, Captain Zakalwe, how are we coming along?
A flowery smell. Thone's preferred scent drifted over from the man. I hope to be flying within a couple of weeks, sir, he said. He'd never liked the CO, but made the effort of smiling bravely.
Do you? Thone said. Do you now? That's not what the doctors say, Captain Zakalwe, unless they're saying different things to me than they are to you.
He frowned. Well, it might be a few weeks, sir.
It might be we have to send you home, I think, Captain Zakalwe, Thone said, with an insincere smile. Or at least to the mainland, as I'm told your home is further afield, eh?
I'm sure I'll be able to return to my duty, sir.
Of course, I realise there will be a medical, but... Yes, 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 Thone said. Well, we'll just have to see, won't we, hmm? Very good.
He stood up.
Is there anything... There's nothing you can get,
he began, then saw the look on Thone's face.
I beg your pardon, sir.
As I was saying, Captain, is there anything I can get you?
He looked down at the white sheets.
No, sir. Thank you, sir.
A speedy recovery, Captain Zakalwe, Thone said frostily.
He saluted Thone, who nodded, turned and left. He was left looking at the white chair. Nurse Taliba came in after a few moments, arms crossed, her round, pale face very calm and kind.
Try to sleep, she told him, and took the chair away.
He woke in the night and saw the lights shining through the snow outside. Silhouetted against the floodlights, the falling flakes became translucent shadows, massing soft against the harsh, downward light. The whiteness beyond in the black night came compromised as grey. He woke with the smell of flowers in his nostrils. He clutched beneath the pillow, felt the single leg of the sharp, long-nosed scissor. He remembered Thone's face. He remembered the briefing room and the four COs. They'd invited him for a drink, said they wanted a word. In the room, one of them, he couldn't remember their names, but he would remember soon, and already he would recognise them. They asked him about what they'd heard he'd said in the mess. And a little drunk, and thinking he was very clever, thinking he might find out something interesting, he'd told them what he suspected they wanted to hear, not what he had said to the other pilots, and had discovered a plot. He wanted the new government to be true to its populist promises and end the war. They wanted to stage a coup, and they needed good pilots. High on the drink and his nerves, he'd left them, thinking he was for them, and gone straight to Thone. Thone, the hard but fair. Thone, the dislikable and petty. Thone, the vain, the perfumed. But Thone, the man known to be pro-government. Though Sayers Insile had once said the man was pro-government with the pilots and anti-government with their superiors. And the look on Thone's face. Not then. Later. After Thone had told him to say nothing to anybody else, because he thought there might be traitors amongst the pilots too, and told him to go to bed as though nothing had happened and he'd gone, and because he'd still been drunk, maybe, woken up that second too late as they came for him, shoved some impregnated rag over his face and held it there while he struggled, but eventually had to breathe, and the choking fumes took him. Dragged through the corridors, socked feet sliding over the tiles, men on either side. They went to one of the hangars, and somebody went to the lift controls, and he still could only dimly see the floor in front of him and could not raise his head, but he could smell flowers from the man on his right. The clamshell doors opened overhead, cracking. He heard the noise of the storm shrieking from the darkness. They dragged him over to the lift. He tensed, swung round, grabbed at Thone's collar, saw the man's face, appalled, full of fear. He felt the man on the other side of him grab at his free arm. He wriggled, got his other arm free from Thone, saw the pistol in the CO's holster. He got the gun. He remembered shouting, getting away but falling. He tried to shoot, but the gun would not work. Lights flickered on at the far side of the hangar.
It's not loaded! It's not loaded!
Thone shouted to the others. They looked over to the far side of the hangar. There were planes in the way. But there was somebody there, shouting about opening the hangar doors at night with the lights on. He never saw who shot him. A sledgehammer hit the side of his head, and the next thing he saw was the white chair. The snow boiled wildly beyond the floodlit windows. He watched it until dawn, remembering and remembering. Taliba, will you send a message to Captain Sayers Insile? Tell him I need to see him, urgently. Please send a message to my squadron, will you?
Yes, of course, but first your medication.
He took her hand in his. No, Taliba. First phone the squadron.
He winked at her. Please? For me? She shook her head. Pest! She walked away through the doors. Well, is he coming?
He's on leave, she told him, taking up the clipboard to check off the medication he was receiving.
Shit!
Sayers hadn't said anything about leave.
Captain,
she said, shaking a bottle. The police, Taliba. Call the military police. Do it now. This really is urgent.
Medication first, Captain.
Well, as soon as I've taken it. You promise?
Promise.
Open wide.
Damn Sayers for being on leave, and damn him twice for not mentioning it. And Thone, the nerve of the man, coming to see him, to check him out, to see if he remembered.
And what would have happened if he had? He felt under the pillow again for the scissor. It was there, cool and sharp.
I told them it was urgent. They say they're on their way, Taliba said, coming in, not with the chair this time.
She looked at the windows, where the storm still blew.
And I've to give you something to keep you awake. They want you perky. I am perky. I am awake. Quiet. And take these.
He took them. He fell asleep, clutching the scissor under the pillow, while the whiteness outside the windows went on, and eventually penetrated the glass, layer by layer, by a process of discrete osmosis, and gravitated naturally to his head, and spun slowly in orbit round him, and joined with the white torus of bandages, and dissolved them, and unwound them, and deposited the remains in one corner of the room, where the white chairs gathered, muttering, plotting, and slowly pressed in against his head, tighter and tighter, whirling in the silly snowflake dance, faster and faster as they came closer and closer, until eventually they became the bandage, cold and tight, about his fevered head, and finding the treated wound, slunk in through his skin and his skull, coldly and crisply and crystally into his brain.
Taliba unlocked the ward doors and let the officers in.
You're sure he's out?
I gave him twice the usual dose. If he isn't out, he's dead.
Still got a pulse. You, take his arms. Okay. Hup. Hey, look at this.
Huh? My fault. I wonder where those had got to. Sorry.
You did fine, kid. You better go. Thanks. This won't be forgotten.
Okay.
What?
It will be quick, yes? Before he wakes up?
Sure. Oh, sure, yeah. He won't ever know. Won't feel a thing.
And so he awoke, in the cold snow, roused by the freezing blast inside him coming to the surface, piercing his skin at every pore, shrieking out. He woke, and knew he was dying. The blizzard had already numbed one side of his face. One hand was stuck to the hard-packed snow beneath him. He was still in the standard-issue hospital pyjamas. The cold was not cold. It was a stunning sort of pain eating into him from every direction. He raised his head, looking around. A few flat meters of snow in what might have been morning light. The blizzard a little quieter than it had been, but still fierce. The last temperature he'd heard quoted had been 10 below, but with the wind chill, it was much, much worse than that. His head and hands and feet and genitals all ached. The cold had woken him. It must have. It must have woken him quickly, or he would already be dead. They must just have left him. If he could find which way they'd gone, follow them. He tried to move, but could not. He screamed inside to produce the most awesome surge of will he had ever attempted, and succeeded only in rolling over and sitting up. The effort of it was almost too much. He had to put his hands behind him to steady himself. He felt them both freeze there. He knew he would never stand up.
Talib,
he thought. But the blizzard swept that away in an instant. Forget Taliba. You're dying. There are more important things. He stared into the milky depths of the blizzard as it swept towards and past him, like tiny soft stars all packed and hurrying. His face felt pierced by a million tiny hot needles, but then started to go numb.
To have come all this way, he thought, just to die in somebody else's war. How silly it all seemed now. Zakalwe, Alithiamel, Stabarind, Livueta, Darkons. The names reeled off were blown away by the sapping cold of the howling wind. He felt his face shrivel, felt the cold burrow through skin and eyeballs to his tongue and teeth and bones. He ripped one hand away from the snow behind him, the cold already anaesthetizing the flayed palm. He opened the jacket of the pyjamas, tore off buttons, and exposed the puckered little mark on his chest over his heart to the cold blast. He put his hand on the ice behind him and tipped his head up. The bones in his neck seemed to grate, clicking as his head moved, as though the cold was seizing up his joints.
"Dark Hans,"
he whispered to the boiling chill of the blizzard. He saw the woman walking calmly towards him through the storm. She walked on the surface of the hard-packed snow, dressed in long black boots and a long coat with a furry black collar and cuffs, and she wore a small hat. Her neck and face were exposed, as were her gloveless hands. She had a long, oval face and deep dark eyes. She walked easily up to him, and the storm behind her seemed to part at her back, and he felt himself in the lee of something more than just her tall body, and something like warmth seemed to seep through his skin wherever it faced her. He closed his eyes. He shook his head, which hurt a little, but he did it all the same. He opened his eyes again. She was still there. She had half knelt in front of him, her hands folded on one skirted knee, her face level with his. He peered forward, wrenched one hand free from the snow again. It was numb, but when he brought the hand round, he saw the raw flesh she'd torn from the snow. He tried to touch her face, but she took his hand in one of hers. She was warm. He thought he had never felt such glorious warmth in all his life. He laughed as she held his hand and the storm parted round her and her breath clouded the air. "God damn," he said. He knew he sounded groggy with the cold and with the drug. "An atheist my entire fucking life. And it turns out the credulous assholes were right all along." He wheezed, coughed. "Or do you surprise them too by not turning up?" "You flatter me, Mr. Zakalwe," the woman said, in a superbly deep and sexy voice. "I am not death or some imagined goddess. I am as real as you." She stroked his torn, bleeding palm with one long, strong thumb. "If a little warmer."
"Oh, I'm sure you're real," he said. "I can feel you're real."
His voice faded. He looked behind the woman. There was a huge shape appearing inside the whirling snow. Grey-white like the snow, but a single shade darker, it floated up behind the woman, quiet and huge and steady. The storm seemed to die just around them. "That's called a 12-person module, Sharadanin," the woman said. "It's come to take you away, if you want to be taken away. To the mainland, if you like, or further afield. Away with us, if you'd prefer that." He was tired of blinking and shaking his head. Whatever insane part of his mind wanted to play this bizarre game out would just have to be humoured for as long as it took. What it had to do with the stabberind and the chair, he couldn't tell yet. But if that was what it was all about, and what else could it be about, then there was still no point, in this weakened, dying state, trying to fight it. Let it happen. He had no real choice.
"With you,"
he said, trying not to laugh.
"With us. We'd like to offer you a job."
She smiled.
"But let's talk somewhere a little warmer, shall we?"
"Warmer?" She made a single tossing motion with her head.
"The module."
"Oh, yeah," he agreed.
"That."
He tried to pull his other hand away from the packed snow behind. Failed. He looked back at her. She had taken a small flask from her pocket. She reached round behind him, slowly poured the flask's contents over his hand. It warmed and came away, steaming gently.
"Okay," she said,
taking his hand, gently helping him up. She pulled some slippers from her pocket.
"Here."
"Oh," he laughed.
"Yeah, thanks."
She put her arm under one of his, her hand under his other shoulder. She was strong.
"You seem to know my name," he said. "What's yours, if that isn't an impertinent question?"
She smiled as they walked through the few flakes of gently falling snow towards the slab-sided bulk of the thing she'd called a module. It had got so quiet, despite the snow nearby streaking past, that he could hear their feet making the snow creak.
"My name," she said, "is Razd Koduresa Dizyet Embles Sma Damarenhide."
"No kidding." "But you may call me Dizyet." He laughed. "Yeah, right. Dizyet." She walked. He stumbled into the orange warmth of the module interior. The walls looked like highly polished wood, the seats like burnished hide, the floor like a fur rug. It all smelled like a mountain garden. He tried to fill his lungs with the warm, fragrant air. He swayed and turned, stunned to the woman.
"This is real," he breathed.
With enough breath, he might have screamed it. The woman nodded.
"Welcome aboard, Sharadanin Zakalwe."
He fainted. Chapter 12. He stood in the long gallery and faced into the light. The tall white curtains billowed softly around him, quiet in the warm breeze. His long black hair was lifted only slightly by the gentle wind. His hands were clasped behind his back. He looked pensive. The silent, lightly clouded skies over the mountains beyond the fortress and the city threw a blank, pervasive light across his face, and standing there like that, in plain dark clothes, he looked somehow insubstantial, like some statue or a dead man propped against the battlements to fool the foe. Somebody spoke his name.
"Zakalwe? Sharadanin?"
"What?"
He came to. He looked into the face of an old man who looked vaguely familiar.
"Beishai?" he heard himself say. Of course. The old man was Zoldrin Beishai, older looking than he remembered.
He looked around, listening. He heard a hum and saw a small, bare cabin.
Seaship? Spaceship?
Osom Imananish, a voice from his memory told him. Spaceship, clipper, bound for... somewhere near Imprin, whatever and wherever that was. Imprin Habitats. He had to get Zoldrin Beishai to the Imprin Habitats. Then he remembered the little doctor and his wonderful field machine with the cutting blue disc. Digging deeper, in a way that would not have been possible without the culture's training and subtle changes, he found the little running loop of memory that took over from what his brain had already stored. The room with the fibre optics, blowing a kiss because it was just what he'd wanted. The explosion, sailing across the bar into the lounge, crashing, hitting his head. The rest was very vague. Distant screams and being picked up and carried. Nothing sensible from the voices he'd registered while he'd been unconscious. He lay for a moment, listening to what his body was telling him. No concussion. Slight damage to his right kidney. Lots of bruises. Abrasions on both knees. Cuts on right hand. Nose still mending. He raised himself up, looked again at the cabin. Bare metal walls, two bunks, one small stool Beishai was sitting on.
"This the brig?"
Beishai nodded.
"Yes, the prison."
He lay back. He noticed he was wearing a disposable crew jumpsuit. The terminal bead had gone from his ear, and the lobe was raw and sore enough to make him suspect the transceiver hadn't relinquished its grip there without a struggle.
"You too, or just me?" he asked.
"Just you."
"What about the ship?"
"I believe we're heading for the nearest stellar system on the vessel's backup drive."
"What's the nearest system?"
"Well, the one inhabited planet is called Mursay. There's a war going on in part of it. One of those brushfire conflicts you mentioned. Apparently the ship may not be allowed to land."
"Land?"
He grunted, feeling the back of his head. Largish bruise.
"This ship can't land. It's not built for in-atmosphere stuff."
"Oh," Zoldrin said. "Well, perhaps they meant we wouldn't be able to go down to the surface."
"Hmm. Must have some sort of orbiter, a space station, yes?"
Beishai shrugged.
"I suppose so."
He looked round the cabin, making it obvious he was looking for something. What do they know about you? He gestured round the cabin with his eyes. Beishai smiled.
They know who I am. I've talked to the captain, Sharadanin. They did receive an order from the shipping company to turn back, though they didn't know why. Now they know why. The captain had the choice of waiting for humanist naval units to pick us up, or heading for Mursay, and he chose the latter, despite some pressure, I believe, from governance via the shipping company. Apparently, he insisted that the distress channel was used when he informed the shipping line of both what had happened to the ship and who I was.
So now everybody knows?
Yes. I imagine by now the whole cluster knows exactly who both of us are. But the point is that I think the captain might not be entirely unsympathetic to our cause.
Yeah? But what happens when we get to Mursay?
Looks like we get rid of you, Mr. Zakhalwe, said a voice from a speaker overhead.
He looked at Beishai. I hope you heard that too.
I believe that might be the captain, Beishai said.
It is, said the man's voice. And we just got informed that we part company before we even get to Mursay Station.
The man sounded peeved. Really, Captain?
Yes, really, Mr. Zakhalwe. I have just received a military communication from the Balzite hegemonarchy of Mursay. They want to uplift you and Mr. Beishai before we connect with the station. As they're threatening to attack us if we don't comply, I intend to do as they ask, technically under protest. But frankly, it will be a relief to be rid of you. I may add that the vessel they intend to take you off with must be a couple of centuries old and was not thought to be spaceworthy until now. If it survives to make the rendezvous in a couple of hours, you ought to have an eventful journey through Mursay's atmosphere. Mr. Beishai, I believe if you reasoned with the Balzite people, they might let you continue with us to Mursay Station. Whatever you decide, sir, let me wish you a safe trip.
Beishai sat back on the small stool.
Balzite, he said, nodding thoughtfully. I wonder why they want us.
They want you, Tsoldrin, he said, swinging his feet off the bed. He looked uncertain. They're on the good guy's side. There's so damn many of these little wars.
Well, in theory they are, Beishai said. I think they believe planets and machines can have souls.
Yeah, I thought they were, he said, getting slowly to his feet. He flexed his arms, moved his shoulders. If this Mursay station is neutral territory, you'd be better going there, though I'd guess this Balzite gang want you, not me. He rubbed the back of his head again, trying to remember what the situation was on Mursay. Mursay was just the sort of place that could start a full-scale war. There was, in effect, a consolidationist-humanist war taking place between relatively archaic military forces on Mursay. Balzite was on the consolidationist side, even though the High Command was some sort of priesthood. Why they wanted Beishai, he wasn't sure, though he vaguely recalled that the priests were into hero worship in a fairly serious way. Though having heard that Beishai was nearby, maybe they just wanted to hold him to ransom. 6 hours later, they rendezvoused with the ancient Balzite spacecraft.
They want me, he said.
They stood by the airlock. Him, Beishai, the awesome Imananesh's captain, and four suited figures with guns. The suited men wore visored helmets, their pale brown faces visible inside, foreheads marked with a blue circle. The circles actually seemed to glow, he thought, and he wondered if they were there because of some generous religious principle to help snipers.
Yes, Mr. Zakhalwe, the captain said.
He was a rotund little man with a shaved head. He smiled.
They want you, not Mr. Beishai.
He looked at the four armed men.
What are they up to? He asked Beishai.
I have no idea, Beishai admitted.
He waved his hands out, appealing to the four men.
Why do you want me?
Please come with us, sir,
one of the suited men said, via a suit speaker in what was obviously not his first language.
Please, he said. You mean I have a choice?
The man looked uncomfortable in his suit. He talked for a while without any noise coming from the speaker, then said,
Sir Zakhalwe, it's very important you come. You must, is very important.
He shook his head.
I must, he repeated, seemingly to himself.
He turned to the captain.
Captain, sir, could I have my earring back, please?
No,
the captain said with a beatific grin.
Now get off my ship.
The craft was cramped and very low tech, and the air was warm and smelled of electrics. They gave him an old suit to put on, and he was shown to a couch and belted in. It was a bad sign when they made you put a suit on inside a ship. The troopers who'd taken him from the clipper sat behind him. The three-man crew, also suited up, seemed suspiciously busy, and he had the disquieting impression that the manual controls in front of them were not just for emergencies. The craft re-entered the atmosphere spectacularly, buffeted, creaking, surrounded by gas glowing bright. Seen through, he realized with a gut-wrenching shock, windows, crystal or glass, not screens, and with a gradually increasing howl. The air got even warmer. Flashing lights, hurried chatter between the crew, and some hurried movements and more excited talk did not make him feel any happier. The glow disappeared, and the sky turned from violet to blue. The buffeting returned. They swept into the night and plunged into cloud. The flashing lights all over the control panels looked even more worrying in the darkness. It was a rolling landing on some sort of runway in a thunderstorm. The four troopers who'd boarded the awesome Emanenish cheered weakly from behind him as the landing gear, wheels he supposed, touched down. The craft trundled on for a worryingly long time, slewing twice. When they finally rolled to a stop, the three crewmen all sat back, slumped in their seats, arms dangling over the edges, silent and staring out into the rain-filled night. He undid the belts, took off the helmet. The troopers opened the interior airlock. When they opened the outer door, it was to reveal rain and lights and trucks and tanks and some low buildings in the background, and a couple of hundred people, some in military uniforms, some in long robes, rain-slicked, some trying to hold umbrellas over others. All seemed to have the circular marks on their foreheads. A group of a dozen or so, all old, robed, white-haired, faces spattered with rain, walked to the bottom of the steps that led from the craft to the ground. "Please, sir," one of the troopers held out a hand to indicate they should descend. The white-haired men in the robes gathered in an arrowhead formation at the foot of the steps. He stepped out, stood on the little platform before the stairs, the rain battered into one side of his head. A great shout went up, and the dozen old men at the foot of the steps each bowed their head and went down on one knee, into the puddles on the dark and wind-whipped runway. A blast of blue light ripped the blackness beyond the low buildings, its flickering brilliance momentarily illuminating hills and mountains in the distance. The assembled people started to chant. It took him a few moments to work out what it was, then realized they were yelling, "Za Gal Wei! Za Gal Wei!" "Uh-oh," he said to himself. Thunder bellowed in the hills. "Yeah, could you just run that past me again? Messiah, I really wish you wouldn't use that word."
Well, Sir Zerkalwe, what do you wish?"
"How about..." He gestured with his hands. "Mister?"
"Sir Zerkalwe, sir, you are preordained. You have been beseen."
The high priest, sitting across the railway carriage, clenched his hands.
"Be seen? Indeed, you are our salvation, our divine recompense. You have been sent."
"Sent," he repeated, still trying to come to terms with what had happened to him. They'd switched the floodlights off shortly after he'd set foot on the ground. The priests enveloped him, took him, many arms round his shoulders, from the concrete apron to an armoured truck. The lights went out on the runway, and they were left with the slit light from the truck and tank lights. Cones made fans by blinkers clipped over the lights. He was bustled away down a track to a railway station where they transferred to a shuttered carriage that clattered into the night. There were no windows.
"Why, yes, our faith has a tradition of finding outside influences because they are always greater."
The high priest, Napueria, he'd said his name was, made a bowing motion.
"And what can be greater than the man who was Comil?"
Comil. He had to dredge his memory for that one. Comil, that was what he had been, according to the cluster's media. Director of military operations, when he and Soldrin Beishai had been involved in the whole crazy dance the last time. Beishai had been Com-Pol, in charge of politics. Ah, these fine divisions. Comil. He nodded, not really much the wiser.
And you think I can help you? Sir Zakalwe, the High Priest said, shifting down from his seat to kneel on the floor again. You are what we believe in.
He sat back in the upholstered cushions.
May I ask why? Sir, your deeds are legend. Forever since the last unpleasantness, our guider, before he died, prophesied that our salvation would come from beyond the skies, and your name was one of those mentioned. So coming to us in our hour of need, you must be our salvation.
I see, he said, seeing nothing. Well, we'll see what we can do.
Messiah!
The train drew up in a station somewhere. They were escorted from it to an elevator, then to a suite of rooms that he was told looked out over the city beneath, but it was all in blackout. The internal screens were closed. The rooms themselves were quite opulent. He inspected them.
Yes, very nice, thank you. And here are your boys, the High Priest said,
sweeping aside a curtain in the bedroom to reveal a languorously displayed half-dozen or so young men lying on a very large bed.
Well, I... thank you, he said, nodding to the High Priest.
He smiled at the boys, who all smiled back. He lay awake in the ceremonial bed in the palace, hands behind his neck. After a while in the darkness, there was a distinct pop, and in a disappearing blue sphere of light, there was a tiny machine about the size of a human thumb.
Zakalwe?
Hi, Sma.
Listen, no, you listen. I would really like to know what the fuck is going on here.
Zakalwe, Sma said through the scout missile. It's complicated, but...
But I'm in here with a gang of homosexual priests who think I'm going to solve all their military problems.
Sharadanine, Sma said in her winning voice. These people have successfully incorporated a belief in your martial prowess into their religion. How can you deny them?
Believe me, it would be easy.
Like it or not, Sharadanine, you've become a legend to these people. They think you can do things.
So what am I supposed to do?
Guide them. Be their general.
That's what they expect me to be, I think. But what should I really do?
Just that, Smar's voice said. Lead them. Meanwhile, Beishai's in the station, Mursay Station. That counts as neutral territory for now, and he's making the right noises. Don't you see, Zakalwe?
Smar's voice sounded tense, exultant.
We've got them. Beishai's doing just what we wanted, and all you have to do is
what?
Just be yourself. Operate for these guys.
He shook his head.
Smar, spell it out for me. What am I supposed to do?
He heard Smar sigh.
Win their war, Zakalwe. We're putting our weight behind the forces you're working with. Maybe if they can win this and Beishai gets behind the winning side here, we can, perhaps, swing the cluster.
He heard her take another deep breath.
Zakalwe, we need this. To a degree, our hands are tied, but we need you to make the whole thing settle out. Win their war for them, and we might just be able to get it all together, seriously.
Fine, seriously, he said to the scout missile. But I've already had a quick look at their maps, and these guys are in deep shit. If they're going to win this war, they're going to need a real miracle.
Just try, Sharadanine, please.
Do I get any help?
How do you mean?
Intelligence, Smar. If you could keep an eye on what the enemies are...
No, Sharadanine, I'm sorry, we can't.
What? He said loudly, sitting up in the bed.
I'm sorry, Zakalwe. Really I am. But we've had to agree to that. This is a really delicate deal here, and we're having to keep strictly out of it. This missile shouldn't even be here, and it'll have to leave soon.
So I'm on my own?
I'm sorry, Smar said.
You're sorry, he said,
collapsing back dramatically on the bed. No soldiering, he recalled Smar saying some time ago now.
No fucking soldiering, he muttered to himself,
as he gathered his hair at the nape of his neck and pulled the little hide band over it. It was dawn. He patted the ponytail and looked out through thick, distorting glass to the mist-shrouded city, just starting to wake to the dawn-rouged mountain peaks and the blue glowing skies above. He looked with distaste at the over-ornamented long robes the priests expected him to wear, then reluctantly put them on. The hegemonarchy and its opponents, the Glassine Empire, had been fighting on and off for control of their modestly sized subcontinent for 600 years, before the rest of the cluster came calling in its strange floating skyships a century ago. They'd been backward even then, compared to the other societies on Mersey, which were decades ahead in technology, and, arguably, several centuries ahead morally and politically. Before they'd been contacted, the natives had the crossbow and the muzzle-loading cannon. Now, a century later, they had tanks. Lots of tanks. Tanks and artillery, and trucks, and a few very inefficient aircraft. Each side also had one prestige system, partially bought from, but mostly just donated, by some of the cluster's more advanced societies. The hegemonarchy had its single sixth or seventh-hand spacecraft. The Empire had a clutch of missiles which were generally reckoned to be inoperable, and probably were politically unusable anyway, because they were supposed to be nuclear-tipped. Public opinion in the cluster could tolerate the technologically enhanced continuation of a pointless war so long as men, women and children died in relatively small, regular batches. But the thought of a million or so being incinerated at once, nuked in a city, was not to be tolerated. The Empire was winning a conventional war then, being waged across two impoverished countries, which left to themselves would probably just be harnessing steam power. Instead, refugee peasants filled the roads. Carts loaded with whole households swayed between the hedgerows, while the tanks ploughed the crop fields and the droning planes dropping bombs took care of slum clearance. The hegemonarchy was retreating across the plains and into the mountains as its beleaguered forces fell back before the Empire's motorized cavalry. He went straight to the map room after dressing. A few dozy general staff officers jumped to attention and rubbed sleep from their eyes. The maps didn't look any better in the morning than they had the previous evening. But he stood looking at them for a long time, sizing up the positions of their forces and the Empire's, asking the officers questions and trying to gauge how accurate their intelligence was and what level their own troops' morale was at. The officers seemed to know more about the disposition of their enemy's forces than they did about the feelings of their own men. He nodded to himself, scanned all the maps, then left for breakfast with Napueria and the rest of the priests. He dragged them all back down into the map room afterwards. They would normally have returned to their own apartments for contemplation, and asked even more questions. "And I want a uniform like these guys," he said, pointing at one of the junior regular army officers in the map room.
"But Sir Zekalway," Napueria said, looking worried, "those would demean you."
"And these will slow me down," he said, indicating the long, heavy robes he was wearing. "I want to take a look at the front myself."
"But, sir, this is the Holy Citadel. All our intelligence comes here. All our people's prayers are directed here."
"Napueria," he said, putting his hand on the other man's shoulder. "I know. But I need to see things for myself. I only just got here, remember?" He looked round the unhappy faces of the other high priests. "I'm sure your ways work when circumstances are as they have been in the past," he told them straight-faced. "But I'm new. So I have to use new ways to discover what you probably already know." He turned back to Napueria. "I want my own plane. A modified reconnaissance aircraft should do. Two fighters as an escort." The priests had thought it the height of daring and orthodoxy to venture out to the spaceport, 30 kilometres away by train and truck. They thought he was mad to want to start flying all over the subcontinent. It was what he did for the next few days, however. There was a lull of sorts in the fighting, just at that point, as the hegemonarchy's forces fled and the Empire's consolidated, which made his task a little easier. He wore a plain uniform, without even the half dozen or so medal ribbons that even the most junior officer seemed to warrant just for existing. He spoke to the mostly dull, demoralised and thoroughly hidebound field generals and colonels, to their staff and to the foot soldiers and tank crews, as well as to the cooks and the supply teams and the orderlies and doctors. Most of the time he needed an interpreter. Only the top brass spoke the cluster's common tongue. But even so, he suspected the troops felt closer to somebody who spoke a different language but asked them questions than they did to somebody who shared their language and only ever used it to give orders. He toured every major airfield in the course of that first week, sounding out the Air Force staff for their feelings and opinions. About the only person he tended to ignore on such occasions was the always watchful priest every squadron, regiment and fort had as its titular head. The first few of these priests he'd encountered had had nothing useful to say, and none of those he saw subsequently ever seemed to have anything interesting to add beyond the ritualized initial greetings. He had decided within the first couple of days that the main problem the priests had was themselves.
"Shinastri province?" Napoeria exclaimed. "But there are a dozen important religious sites there. More. And you propose to surrender without a fight?"
"You'll get the temples back once we've won the war, and probably lots of new treasure to put inside them. They're going to fall whether we try to hold there or not, and they'll probably be damaged if not destroyed in the fighting. This way they'll survive intact, and it stretches their supply lines like crazy. Look, the rains start in, what, a month? By the time we're ready to counterattack, they'll have even worse supply problems. The wetlands behind them mean they can't bring stuff that way, and they can't retreat there once we do attack. Nappy, old son, this is beautiful, believe me. If I was a commander on the other side, and I saw this area being offered, I wouldn't go within a million clicks of it. But the Imperial Army boys are going to have to, because the court won't let them do anything else. But they'll know it's a trap. Terrible for the morale."
"I don't know. I don't know."
Napoeria shook his head, both his hands at his mouth, massaging his lower lip while he looked worriedly at the map. "No, you don't know," he thought to himself, watching the man's nervous body language. "You lot haven't known anything very useful for generations, chum." "It must be done," he said. "The withdrawal should start today." He turned to another map. "Aircraft, stop the bombing and strafing of the roads. Give the pilots 2 days' rest, then raid the oil refineries here." He pointed. "A mass raid. Use everything with the range that'll fly."
"But if we stop attacking the roads..."
"They'll fill with even more refugees," he told the man. "That'll slow the Imperial Army down more than our planes. I do want some of these bridges taken out." He tapped a couple of river crossings. He looked mystified at Napoeria. "You guys signed some sort of agreement not to bomb bridges or something?"
"It has always been felt that destroying bridges would hinder a counterattack, as well as being wasteful," the priest said unhappily.
"Well, these three have to go anyway." He tapped the surface of the map. "That and the refinery raid should put some sand in their fuel lines," he said, clapping his hands together and rubbing them.
"But we believe the Imperial Army has great reserves of fuel,"
Napoeria said, looking very unhappy. "Even if they have," he told the High Priest, "commanders will move more cautiously, knowing supplies have been interrupted. They're careful guys. But I bet they never did have the supplies you thought. They probably think you have bigger supplies than you do. And with the advance they've had to fund recently, believe me, they may panic a little if the refinery raid comes off the way I hope it will." Napoeria looked downcast, rubbed his chin while he gazed forlornly at the maps.
"It all sounds very..."
he began.
"Very... adventurous."
The High Priest invested the word with a degree of loathing and contempt that might have been amusing in other circumstances. Under great protest, the High Priests were persuaded they must give up their precious province and its many important religious sites to the enemy. They agreed to the mass raid on the refinery. He visited the retreating soldiers and the main airfields that would take part in the refinery raid. Then he took a couple of days travelling the mountains by truck, inspecting the defences. There was a valley with a dam at its head that might also provide an effective trap if the Imperial Army made it that far. He remembered the concrete island, the snivelling girl in the chair. While he was driven along the rough roads between the hill forts, he saw 100 or more aircraft drone overhead, heading out across the still peaceful-looking plains, their wings loaded with bombs. The refinery raid was expensive. Almost a quarter of the planes never came back. But the Imperial Army's advance halted a day later. He had hoped they would keep on coming for a bit. Their supplies hadn't been supplied straight from the refinery, so they could have kept going for a week or so. But they'd done the sensible thing and stopped for the moment. He flew to the spaceport, where the lumbering spaceship, it looked even more dangerous and dilapidated in daylight, was being slowly patched up and repaired in case it was ever wanted again. He talked to the technicians, took a look round the ancient device. The ship had a name, he discovered. The Hegemonarchy Victorious. It's called Decapitation, he told the priests. The Imperial Court travels to Willitice Lake at the start of every second season. The High Command comes to brief them. We drop the Victorious in on them, the day the General Staff arrive. The priests looked puzzled.
With what, Sir Zekelway? A commando force? The Victorious is only able to hold...
No, no, he said. When I say drop it, I mean we bomb them with it. We put it into space and then bring it back in, down on top of the Lake Palace. It's a good 400 tons. Even travelling at only 10 times the speed of sound, it'll hit like a small nuke going off. We'll get the entire court and the General Staff in one go. We offer peace to the Commoners' Parliament immediately. With any luck at all, we cause immense civil disturbance. Probably the Commoners' Parliament will see this as their chance to grab real power. The army will want to take up the reins itself and may even have to turn round and fight a civil war. Junior aristos filing competing claims should complicate the situation nicely.
But, Napueria said, this means destroying the Victorious, does it not?
The other priests were shaking their heads.
Well, impacting at 4 or 5 kilometres a second wouldn't leave it totally undented, I suspect.
But Zekalwe!
Napueria roared, doing a reasonable impression of a small nuclear explosion himself.
That's absurd! You can't do it! The Victorious is a symbol of... It's our hope! All the people look at her!
He smiled, letting the priest ramble on for a little while. He was fairly certain the priests looked on the Hegemonarchy Victorious as their escape route if things went badly in the end. He waited until Napueria had almost finished, then said,
I understand, but the craft is on its last legs already, gentlemen. I've talked to the technicians and the pilots. It's a death trap. It was more luck than anything else that it got me here safely.
He paused, watching the men with the blue circles on their foreheads look wide-eyed at each other. The muttering increased. He wanted to smile.
That had put the fear of God into them.
I'm sorry, but this is the one thing the Victorious is good for. He smiled. And it could indeed produce victory. He left them to mull over the concepts of high hypersonic dive bombing. No, no suicide mission required. The craft's computers were perfectly capable of taking it up and